This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
How much sporting merchandise do you have? Does merch maketh the fan? It's Socceroos Eve and so many of us are going to be up at five watching them take on USA. Will you be digging into your Aussie merch to wear it even if you're just in your lounge room watching on the telly? Do you think you're even a fan if you don't? Or is that just all commercial nonsense? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. I confess I have way too many scarves, but ones that I'll never get rid of. Every time the cull comes around, I refuse to get rid of my sporting scarves, my Storm scarves, my Saints scarves, my Aussie scarves, of course. I'd love to hear from you. How much merchandise do you have? What's your oldest piece of merch? Is it as valuable now as it used to be if you're in a club that has scarves every single season that prove you're up to date with your membership? And if so, do you wear them all with pride, maybe all at the same time? Is it all hype to make money? Clubs make millions out of this, of course. I was looking it up. FC Barcelona generates $440 million in sales of T-shirts and merch. Not all of it goes to the clubs. But has it all gone a bit far and you turn away from the merch? Maybe you make an exception for Aussie teams like the Socceroos. I'd love to hear from you. Join the conversation as we are on Socceroos Eve, of course. A lot of people are heading to the pubs before the sun's up to watch the match. Yes, it starts at 5 a.m. Some pubs are open from 4. I'm going to find out what the volume levels are for pubs in the morning at 5 o'clock for, let's hope, multiple roars coming from the crowd for those Socceroo goals. And we're also going to talk soon about what it's like to be an American living right here, right now in Melbourne on Socceroos Eve. There's a lot of anti-American sentiment that's been kicked up, ironically, largely by an Englishman. Tell me, are you watching the game? Where are you watching the game? And what will you be wearing? How much green and gold will you be decking yourself out in? Or will you be wearing your true colours on the inside? Jenny in Fitzroy says, I've got those annual membership scarves for Vixens and it drives me nuts. What a waste. Do you think merch is a waste or do you lean into it, and particularly when it comes to the Socceroos? Also this hour, talking of being Australian, and on a completely different note, there are about 7,000 people here who might feel the sting of watching these joyous scenes, people all around the world celebrating their national teams for the World Cup, because those 7,000 people or thereabouts are officially without a country. They're living in Australia, living as stateless. What does that mean? What sort of barriers do they face? We talk a lot about immigration policy. We talk about citizens. We talk about migrants. We talk about residents, permanent or not. But this group is mostly forgotten and unseen. I'm going to be looking into a new report on that, and I'm looking forward to a conversation with one young woman who's been making great strides even while facing the hurdles posed by being stateless in Australia. That is later this hour on The Conversation Hour. But next, what's it like being an American on the eve of the Socceroos showdown with the US of A?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Ed Wyatt, who's an American-Australian sports journalist and finds himself in that tricky situation as a dual citizen and living here with the Australians taking on USA tomorrow morning. Hi, Ed. How are you going?
Hello, Mary. How are you? I'd be lying if I wasn't saying I'm a little bit nervous.
Okay. I'll ask straight up. How difficult is it for you emotionally right now and as you approach the game? Who will you be going for?
It's very hard. I'll be honest with you. It's very difficult for me, having lived in both countries, a citizen in both countries, having worked and covered the game in both countries. So I would be lying if I wasn't saying I'm hoping for a draw, because both teams can go through. I don't have to worry about anyone from Australia getting in my face or anyone from America getting in my face. I'll just be happy. Let's both move on. And if we meet later, we meet later.
Let's both move on. I fear that you've been touched, maybe scarred by some of this stuff that's been kicked up by. Let's go back and sum this up for people. What we're referring to is one guy, a journeyman, I think you'd describe him in the soccer world, an Englishman who never quite cracked it for any national team. His name is Mike Grella. For people who aren't familiar with this, block your ears if you need to, Ed. But he's created a bit of a firestorm online, kind of broke the internet because of this particular comment that he made about the Socceroos.
I love Australians. I'm like, oh, these Australians, maybe they're right. What are they drinking over there? Because they got no shot of doing anything at the World Cup, right? And they're the weakest team in the group. There's no shot Australia could compete with the U.S. And so the only way they can play is in defense and try to keep nil-nil, and that's the only way.
Yeah, that's Mike Grella, and he's since doubled down and quadrupled down, Ed. And anyone who wants to comment on Mike Grella, 1300 222 774, tell Ed what you think about Mike. Yes, what I gather from your response, Ed, you sort of pained by this trash talk that's been going either way?
Yeah, I think a lot of American fans, a lot of American media members, and even the team, some of the players came out and said, look, this is completely wrong. We totally respect Australia. They're a very, very good team. I think it's kind of the way the modern media is working, Mary, at the moment. So when Australia and the U.S. were in the same group, I think both countries were kind of relieved because they didn't draw someone bigger like a France or a Norway or someone like that. So the response to that kind of makes sense. But then to take it to that next level and say it's a layup, obviously like an easy shot in basketball. They're not very good. They're not going to make any noise. You know, that was completely sort of hot take stuff, I think, that was probably designed cynically in a way, unless he really feels this way, which I'm not sure he does, because he is on TV, watches a lot of football. So I don't know if he actually believes this or whether he was just trying to create the viral firestorm that he has done. But I don't think many American fans in the know would share these same feelings.
And certainly the players didn't either. The US players have said, whoa, we're showing respect.
Absolutely. And I think it's two very good teams. Australia is certainly not the weakest team in the group. I think if you watch Paraguay in that first game against the U.S., they were not very good. Turkey was not very good either. I think it's just a ridiculous thing. But it's put a lot of eyes on the game now, and it's hyped it up a bit. So it's certainly going to have a big audience both here and in the U.S., I think, and globally.
Of course, we are talking about the World Cup. We're talking about Socceroos taking on USA, and we're also talking about merch, because when we talk about being patriotic, a lot of it comes out in our clothes. I want to ask you, what's your oldest piece of merch, your best piece of merch? Do you run away from merch and just think that that's all commercial nonsense? I'm talking to Ed Wyatt, who is an American-Australian sports journalist, as I said, a dual citizen. Which scarves will you be having around? Do you have a lot of merch, Ed, and which ones will you be wearing?
I do have a lot of merch. I'll be honest with you. Going back to, I'm an Arsenal fan, so I've got about 9 or 10 different Arsenal shirts.
9 or 10?
I've got a lot over the years. I've got a New York Knicks jacket that my wife picked up back in New York in like the 90s. So I brought that out when the Knicks won the
NBA. I was going to say, got a title. Recent airing.
Yeah, even though I'm not a Knicks fan. I've got a Socceroos
scarf. Ed. Can you wear it if you're not a fan? 1300 222 774. I want you to weigh in. Can Ed Wyatt wear a Knicks jersey if he's not a fan? What's your thoughts, Ed?
I just put it on just to sort of say, because it was kind of cool. It's an old starter jacket, so I thought people would appreciate it. But I did make it clear I was not a Knicks fan, and I'm not wearing it around town. So I will throw that out there now. But I do have a Socceroos scarf. I have a U.S. national team hat and a jacket that I got years ago. So I can sort of wear both, and then depending on what happens, take one off, one or the other off.
Yes, and if it's
in... doesn't it?
Well, that's right. Well, look, where will you be actually watching, Ed? Because if you're by yourself, maybe it's, you know, merch that's falling in the forest and no one needs to know.
I will be watching it at home. I don't think this is the kind of game where I could go out and watch in public, certainly not in Australia or even in the US. So,
oh, why?
I will just be too nervous and too, I'm not sure how it's going to unfold, and I just wouldn't want to be, I just have to be, for very, very big games, I have to sort of be on my own. When my football team was the Denver Broncos in the NFL, when they won their first Super Bowl, I literally had to watch it on my own because I couldn't bear to be with anyone else. I was so nervous. So,
that's true.
Yeah. I think this one falls into that category. If it were the U.S. against someone else or the Socceroos against someone else, no problem at all. But I think because they're playing each other, I think it makes it a little more difficult for me personally.
I mean, who would you be going for then?
I'll be honest with you. There's be a slight bias towards the U.S. because I just think this is really important for the U.S. to go deep in this tournament, being a home tournament. That's my gut feeling. However, again, as I said, because neither team will probably be eliminated, it's not an elimination game. I think it'll be okay whoever wins this one, or even if it ends in a draw. If it were a knockout elimination game, I would be much more stressed, and I'm not sure who I'd want to win. I'd probably just watch it, and whoever wins, wins.
Whoever wins, wins.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're listening to the very conflicted Ed Wyatt, American-Australian sports journalist. I'm asking you, tell us about your best piece of merch. How much merch have you got, or do you reject all of your merch? This, you can sew all your old scarves together and turn them into a blanket. That is a really good thought. Someone is saying, look, sorry to be bar humbug, but I think merchandise is incredibly wasteful. Who needs multiple jerseys or scarves each year or each game? And wouldn't that money be better spent on donations to grassroots level development and access to sports for underprivileged kids? That's from Heather as well. Tell me, give us a call, 1300 222 774. Tell me your thoughts about merch. Ed Wyatt is still with us, very nervous American Australian sports journalist. You also have a connection to both of the teams, let alone both of the countries, Ed.
Yeah, well, as I said, I've covered the game in both countries, worked for SBS here, worked for Fox in the States. One of my good friends here is the ex-Socceroo, Steve Horvat. So I've known him for years. Good friend of mine, Casey Keller, played in goal for the U.S. for a number of years, also played in England for Millwall. So I do actually know people who are involved in these teams and have a real a foot in each camp, if you will. So that makes it harder for me as well, too, because I know how much it means to these programs, to these ex-players, these current players. So,
and you lived and worked in Seattle, and that's where it's being played.
That's another weird connection. You're right, Mary.
Tell us about, paint a picture for us of that stadium, what you believe and have heard that the atmosphere is like there.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. I mean, Seattle is a very progressive city, much like Portland, which is my hometown. The Northwest has been very tuned into football, soccer for a long, long time. So it will definitely be the street parties are crazy. They've got a floating barge in Puget Sound there that is actually got a watch party there, so you can actually be out on the water watching it. The stadium is known as one of the loudest, probably the second loudest in the NFL. So it's got huge, great acoustics and atmosphere. So I think it's going to be insane. I know a lot of Aussies are over there now. They went to Vancouver, and then it's only about a three-hour drive down to Seattle from Vancouver. So they make that road trip down. They're in Seattle now. The American fan, the ticket prices are crazy. So it's going to be, the atmosphere is going to be off the charts. Trust me, it's going to be really great. That stadium absolutely rocks when it's packed. So I think it's going to be a real spectacle on Saturday morning.
Oh, well, if you're in a loud stadium or if you're in the very quiet, nervous lounge room like Ed Wyatt, best of luck to all of us. And thank you so much, Ed. Maybe we should check in with you once we know the results
then
next week.
Feel free. No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
That's Ed Wyatt. Wyatt, American Australian sports journalist. Well, he's talking about a very loud stadium, and we've heard that they are absolutely booming in all of the host countries for the World Cup. What's it going to be like at the local pub? Because there are pubs open from four, some of them, tomorrow morning. What's it going to be like if a pub near you is erupting with hopefully lots and lots of Socceroo goals? It's not just pubs, of course. It might be your next door neighbours. We're going to be talking about how people are preparing, whether they're leaving their lounge room or not. Tell me what you're doing. How are you preparing?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
I am asking you, tell me about your merch. Are you going to be draping yourself in it for the Socceroos tomorrow morning? And what are you doing at 5 a.m? Yes, some people might be sleeping in, but if you're planning to watch it, where are you going? Will you be going to a pub? And what does that look like at 5 o'clock in the morning or even earlier? Andy Smith is co-owner of the Vic Hotel in Footscray, and you'll be opening up early, Andy.
I will. Mary, good morning. Yes, I 4:45 will be open, ready to go with breakfast and beers and lots of TVs.
I'm ashamed or proud to say that I didn't know about alcohol rules at 4 o'clock in the morning, Andy. What's the actual rule there?
Oh, well, the government's liquor licensing have gone out early and offered out extension on licences during the World Cup campaign, which right. has been brilliant for everybody.
Okay. So are you expecting many people?
Yeah, we've got just over about 120 for
120?
Breakfast. Yeah, for breakfast tomorrow morning. So,
okay, so I beg your pardon, Andy. I was just about to say the alcohol is allowed, but then what happens with the noise? We know that it's okay in a stadium to be screaming your head out, but what do you do with that many people? You're running around shushing people?
Well, no, we're lucky. It's all enclosed inside the bar, so we're very lucky. We've got a large bar that holds that many people, so it's fully contained. So no outside TVs, no outside noise. So everything's contained within the building, within the pub itself, which
and,
is great.
And are you being unashamedly pro Socceroo?
For my dodgy accent, I do come from somewhere else in the world. Absolutely, Socceroos bound tomorrow.
Okay.
I can't promise anything if we meet England in the final. I'm not too sure.
Okay, split down the middle there.
Yeah,
And Andy, are you piling on your merch? Whether it's for that country or the Australians?
Oh, listen, there'll be definitely a lot of Australian green and gold happening tomorrow. There'll be balloons, and you'll definitely know that you're in an Australian supporters pub. As I say, breakfast going from 5 o'clock as well, so there'll be enough to keep people going.
Andy, thank you for letting us know what's happening at the Vic. Appreciate it.
Great, Mary. Take care. Have a good day.
You too. Andy Smith is from the Vic Hotel. Wes Lambert is CEO of the Australian Restaurant and Cafe Association. He can tell us a bit more about what's happening out there in hospitality at 4 a.m. Hi, Wes. Thanks for joining us.
good morning.
How many pubs and clubs, I guess, will be open in time for the 5 o'clock kickoff?
I mean, look, as long as they apply to vary their license and conditions in Victoria, which there is a mechanism to do so, I expect that many hospitality businesses will open their doors for this epic game.
Yeah. And so we were talking there about you need your license for the alcohol. What about the noise restrictions? How do you stop Socceroo fans from going absolutely crazy?
Well, look, I won't endorse anything that's not to the rule book, to the letter. I think we as Australians are all pushing for the team to win, and hopefully local councils will understand that it is a time of celebration, and we should all be in this together.
Taking this to a semi-serious level, Wes, so that's what would happen, is it? If a pub at 5 a.m. is making too much noise, it might come down to council level?
Well, look, it'd be your local... I'm sure that You know, there are not that many Victorian liquor license officers out at 5 a.m. But
maybe they're out and about tomorrow.
Well, probably on that day. But ultimately, complaints are made to by residents to their local council, which the DA, which ultimately awards a business the ability to operate, is council, and then liquor license and gaming licenses are staked. And we're getting into way too much detail. We expect that lots and lots of hospitality businesses over the weekend will benefit from this match.
I'm asking you if you are going to head to a pub, or if you just prefer to be nervous in your own lounge room. 1300 222-774 is the number to call. Wes Lambert, how much of a boost do you think that pubs and hospitality venues are going to get tomorrow morning? Is it substantial?
I mean, look, it's this doesn't happen very often, right? These matches only come around, in years apart. And so, we fully expect that the businesses that are open, that are trading tomorrow morning, they will probably be busting at the seams.
Busting at the seams. Wes Lambert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Wes Lambert is CEO of the Australian Restaurant and Cafe Association. Is the Great Northern going to be busting at the seams? Paul Capovilla, I beg your pardon, is the General Manager of the Great Northern. Thanks for joining me, Paul.
No problem at all.
What are the numbers looking like at the Great Northern?
They're looking pretty massive, actually, at the moment. The game on Sunday surprised us absolutely, and it was a good vibe. And following on that, going on to tomorrow in the morning and the graveyard shift there, we're looking fully booked. We are leaving spaces for walk-ins, but I have a feeling we might have a bit of a line out the front. Wow. We'll see how we go.
Were you really surprised about the Sunday match?
Well, I mean, we get busy quite often. I have seen busy nights there and busy days there for big events. And this one, it did take me. I was prepared for the worst in terms of having as many staff and every beer tap flowing, et cetera. And the patrons, they surprised me. Let's put it that way, in a good way. It was a pleasant day. It was a very, very pleasant day. But I was like, we're going to put in more elbow grease here.
Well, and as you say, getting in some more staff for that graveyard shift, it'll be quite a different atmosphere for 5 a.m.
Indeed, yes.
Paul, good luck with all of that, and wishing you a very happy game.
Indeed. Thank you so much. Enjoy. Hopefully we win.
Yes, indeed. Paul Capovilla is General Manager of the Great Northern. Are you going to be joining with fellow-minded Socceroo fans, 1300-222-774, or would you prefer to be sitting in your lounge room? Are you going to be wrapped in merch? How do you feel about merch? Bassam in Coburg says, in 2004 at the Melbourne Grand Prix, I bought everything Jaguar because of Weber. Umbrella, T-shirt, cap, computer bag, spending over $300, which was a lot of money for in 2004. And then he goes to another team following year. Bassam, I feel your pain. This on text, I like unofficial merch, like the original ball from the 1930 final that I made from old socks. Oh, that's very good. And this on text from Ram in Glen Waverley. I've still got the Tim Cale jumper and wearing it today to the office. I'll be wearing for the tomorrow morning, early morning match as well. Tell me about your merch. How many years of merch do you get from your club? Maybe that's all a bit of a waste. We've been having a bit of that on text as well. Coming up next, I'm going to be having a very different conversation. We've been enjoying, celebrating the Socceroos because it's a wonderful opportunity for us to all band together under the national team. Well, there are about 7,000 people here who might just feel like the sting of watching people all around the world celebrating their teams is a little bit difficult because these people are stateless. They are living here with a lot of hurdles. I'm going to be talking with a young woman who is officially stateless and ask how that is affecting her life, as well as talking to the co-author of a report into this about what needs to be done about that. And then also later in the hour, you have been so generous with your Meals for Melbourne food drive. We've had dozens and dozens of donations. It's made up dozens and dozens of heavy boxes I'm going to be crossing before the hour is out to our loading bay in South Bank, where staff and presenters are going to be forming a human chain to pass all of those wonderful boxes into the trucks. We'll hear about that and see where the RAF's putting his shoulder into it. That's coming up a little later this hour. But next, what does it mean to be stateless in Australia?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It is The Conversation Hour, and I'm really looking forward to my next conversation with these guests I have in front of me in the studio. We've been talking a lot about immigration policy. We talk about migrants, we talk about residents, we talk about citizens, but do we talk about the people who are stateless? More than 7,000 people living in Australia right now in a legal limbo. What is that like to be stateless, and why is it happening? A major new report from Peter McMullen Centre on Statelessness at Melbourne Law School has found that they're facing years of uncertainty and limited rights and barriers to education, employment, healthcare, the whole lot. In particular, among them are Rohingya people who fled persecution in Myanmar, and they've arrived here hoping for safety and good, you know, fulfilling lives, and find themselves in this limbo. So joining me in the studio is Professor Michelle Foster, who's Dean of Law at Melbourne University and a co-author of the report. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Mary.
And Asma Naeemullah, who is one of the people that we are talking about, a young woman who is living with this experience. Thanks for joining me, Asma.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I want to go to you and hear your full story in context, because I think that that's really important for people to hear and to hear the human stories behind this. But just before we start, a sort of a quick backgrounder from you, Michelle. For people who might not have heard the term before or be quite clear about what stateless means, one of the things that really struck me about the report is that Australia actually has no formal definition of it. So tell us about that.
Thanks, Mary, and thanks so much for having us. So to be stateless is to not be recognised as a citizen by any country in the world. That's really hard for most of our listeners to get their head around, because of course everyone's born somewhere. Everyone belongs to a family, to a network, to a community. They belong to their country, but they don't legally belong. The reason they don't legally belong is usually explained on the basis of discrimination. So many people, including the Rohingya people, are excluded from citizenship on the basis of race discrimination, religious discrimination, ethnic discrimination, gender discrimination. So we have 24 countries in the world that don't allow women to pass on their nationality to their children. So often discrimination explains why a person has no nationality, and then the consequences of having no nationality, of being stateless, are severe. It excludes people from access to the most basic rights.
So you've picked out, just to go back slightly, sorry to interrupt you, but sometimes it's about that ability to pass on a name. It's not necessarily Australia's rules in that particular case. It can be lots of different things.
Yeah, so there's an international definition of statelessness, which is a person who's not recognised as a national by any country. So that definition is clear. The reasons why a person isn't recognised may be explained on a whole lot of different reasons, but if they don't have a nationality, then they're stateless. And Australia does have an obligation to recognise stateless people and to protect them. But as you pointed out, we do not have, in our domestic law, we have no system of defining statelessness, of identifying stateless people, or understanding what they need, and then therefore having an ability to protect them. Mm. So what we're really dealing with is people who do have protection needs, that have suffered, in many cases, severe discrimination, and yet they're trying to navigate a system that almost pretends they don't exist. So that's the challenge that we've identified in this report. What does it mean to be a person who's trying to navigate a system that has not been built for them? And what does it mean for all the people, the healthcare workers, the people educating stateless people, the lawyers, the decision makers, who are trying to help people navigate a system which, again, essentially pretends they don't exist because there's no definition or no rules to help those people, help stateless people navigate the system?
You've given us a really good overview of that situation. Asma, I want to hear your story. You came to Australia in 2013 when you were 10, so you're 23 now. You arrived by boat with your siblings and parents. Tell me, what do you remember from that time?
I came to Australia by boat. We fled our home in Myanmar when I was 10 years old with my parents and my siblings. It was very traumatic. It was a small boat with over 100 people. It feels like you are lost at sea. Everyone is desperate to survive in a big, scary ocean. I saw people drown. I think it will affect me for the rest of my life.
So you've already got that trauma from the boat.
Yes.
And then you do get to, I think it's Sydney, and you're going to school. What's it like processing that trauma then, and in just even that alone, before we even get to the idea of being stateless?
There was a lot of good and bad experiences. It was good that I could finally go to school in Sydney, but there was a lot of bullying by some teachers and students because I was a refugee. And when it came to the end of year 12, suddenly I had nowhere to go.
Yeah. And this idea of being stateless, when did you become conscious of that? When did people start saying that to you, and how did you process something like that?
I think the first time I learned what really statelessness means is when I went to a statelessness conference in Malaysia in 2024. And that's also when I came back, is suddenly when I got my permanent residency after 11 years. I came to Australia in 2013. And the fact that it took 11 years to just become a resident and eventually become a Australian citizen, I've been like stateless. I was born to statelessness for 23 years, which is basically my whole life. So I think there's a lot of happiness that I finally, you know, no longer stateless, but there's also a lot of grief because it took this long. It just prolonged the suffering. And I don't really identify as a stateless person throughout my life because I know where I'm from. I am a Rohingya person from Burma, but we're not accepted there. But I still believe that I have the right to know who I am, which is Rohingya.
Mm. And I'll ask you in a moment, Michelle, if that's a typical story in terms of the time. But Asma, to take that long, what did that mean to you when people were saying that you were stateless, and you're talking about you know your identity? But what did it make you feel like when they said you were stateless, or how did that make you think that how people regarded you?
I felt like an alien for majority of my life because of this type of identity. That people choose to decide who I am. And it just makes you very isolated at times, socially withdrawn because you can't access things like other people. So being called an illegal immigrant or a stateless person, it's just very dehumanizing language and experience. And I believe that no one should ever go through something like that.
You're listening to Asma Naimullah, who is a Rohingya woman and has had experience of statelessness. And also with me is Michelle Foster, who is Dean of Law at Melbourne University and co-author of a report on this. Michelle, how typical is that timeline for like Asma had to face? And what are the hurdles that Asma's referring to?
Yeah, so Mary, unfortunately it is quite typical. One of the things that really emerged clearly from our study, where we interviewed about 95 people who are dealing, either have lived experience of statelessness or who are supporting stateless people, we found this common, consistent theme of the relentlessness of the system. And what is meant by that is because there's no rules, there's no definition of statelessness, there's no statelessness determination procedure, so there's no point at which an authoritative decision is made about is the person stateless or not.
So the people who help with migration and with migrants and that process, they can't help people?
Well, they're trying to fit a person who's stateless into a system that doesn't accommodate them. Mm. So they're trying to maybe put them through the protection visa system that's based on people who are refugees. Not all stateless people are refugees. They're going through all different sort of methods or mechanisms to try to support people. But a person and a decision maker may say, yes, the person's stateless, and they start going down a certain path. But then because there's no proper statelessness determination procedure, the next person who comes along, the next decision maker will say, well, no, we don't agree with that. We're going to restart. We're going to start again. So we found in our study people who are on temporary visas, who are in temporary situations, having to constantly re-establish their case, constantly prove again. And even where they had a protection visa, when they came later to apply for citizenship, the department would say, well, there's never been a proper statelessness determination or a determination of your statelessness, so we're going to start again. So the relentlessness of constantly having to establish, and at no point does the music stop, so to speak. There's never that authoritative point. I mean, it has an impact, of course, on those who are stateless, but it has an impact on the whole system, which has led us to say that really the system is dysfunctional.
Well, how does it compare with other countries?
So there are many other countries that have stateless people. Stateless people are all around the globe, and most of the countries that we would compare ourselves to, the UK, for example, in 2014 set up a statelessness determination procedure. The Netherlands have recently set up a determination procedure. France has had a statelessness determination system since the 1950s. So it's not a new idea that one would set up a statelessness determination procedure. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, that has the responsibility for stateless people, has set out really clearly how one would set up a system to determine statelessness. The rules that are available are really clear. We just need to implement them into Australian law.
We're talking about statelessness on the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Asma, you talked about then the link between statelessness, this idea, this label, and identity. But it also comes down to really practical hurdles, doesn't it? How did it affect your life as you were going through schooling, as you're thinking about your future? What were the things that jumped out that you thought, hang on, no one else is going through this?
So for me, this mainly started at the end of year 12, as I mentioned previously, because I wasn't a permanent resident yet. I wasn't seen as a domestic student at universities. And while my peers were just worried about their grades, I was not just worried about that, but also how can I afford it? Because I didn't have access to HECS loans. So, and scholarships are very competitive. So there were things that I had to do. Actually, it took me like a whole year after HSC to apply to endless applications to eventually get access to like a pathway course. So I had to do a diploma and then transfer to a bachelor degree. So it took me a lot longer than my peers who were born here with permanent residency and Australian citizenship, who had access to these support, government support. As we are, a majority of us who are refugees have financial difficulties. So for me, I had these extra unnecessary problems and challenges that I faced, which has affected my mental health, access to affordable mental health support, and basically like not being able to have a dignified way of living. Like I was constantly in survival mode, which is, I think, is already like having a life, living a life that has been already traumatic. It's just like adding on and on. And I think it's really important that we improve these policies that affect us, like status people.
Michelle, does that resonate? You obviously, with your report, interviewed a lot of people. This idea of uncertainty affecting mental health, was that a common experience?
It was common, Mary. And I think one of the things that really emerged from the study was this idea, and I mean, Asma has really explained it very well, that often people have left a country where they've experienced generations, intergenerational statelessness, where they've been excluded from that society. And unfortunately, the experience that they've had in coming to Australia has largely mirrored many of the deprivations that they've suffered in their home country. That was a really compelling finding of this report, because it's just unfortunately so typical of the experience of stateless people in Australia. So it's the lack of education, the lack of access to all the basic services, the mental health impacts, that sort of prolonged sense of not belonging somewhere, that is just so damaging to stateless people.
Even if I wanted, Michelle, to avoid politics in this conversation, I don't think it's possible. And you're landing this report in the middle of a really hot debate about immigration policy across multiple parties. Is this, how much of this is a legal problem that's been stuck in bureaucracy, and how much, potentially increasingly more, is it becoming a political problem?
Look, Mary, I mean, as you've indicated, any discussion around the rights of non-citizens is going to be political. But I suppose I would implore us to look at the evidence, to look at the situation. We're not talking about hundreds of thousands of people. We're talking about really a very small cohort of people who are here, that are trying to establish a life with dignity and have so very much to offer this country. I mean, how could anyone listen to Asma and not understand the enormous contribution that stateless people can make to Australian society.
And indeed, we're going to talk about exactly how much ASMA has already achieved, and I will get to that. But do you fear that this academic research and, you know, a legal conundrum that's a sort of a structural issue is increasingly going to be a victim of politics, particularly in Australia in 2026?
Look, Mary, again, I mean, I've been thinking and researching about refugee issues for over 20 years. There's always been, political context to this. But I think as a legal academic, as someone who is taking a very principled approach to these issues, we need to keep having these sensible evidence-based conversations. I mean, I would be really concerned if the political landscape prevented us from having these really sensible conversations.
I am getting a flavour on text about asking, you know, about the rights of stateless people to get here into the system. What would you have to say about that? Are you asking for essentially stateless people find themselves in that category to be treated in the same way as the migrant population, or is it an overhaul of all of the system that you would like to see?
This report is focusing on the rights of stateless people, and it's recognising that Australia in 1973 signed on to an international treaty to protect stateless people. That was a very clear obligation. And yet here in 2026, we still haven't done exactly as we said we would do. We haven't implemented that system of protection. So we are very much focused on stateless people. Our argument is that stateless people are here, that they do need protection, that pretending they're not here is creating all sorts of problems for stateless people themselves, but also makes the system dysfunctional.
And if we're not meeting our international obligations, the first question is, how have we gotten away with that? But who speaks on behalf of stateless people?
Well, that's the question.
ASMA Naimullah is with me, as well as Michelle Foster, who you've just been hearing from. This is on the heels of a report into statelessness in Australia. ASMA, we were just talking there about, how much you can contribute, and you among all of 7,000 people. And you have already, despite all of the problems and the hurdles that have been placed in front of you, you got to university, you've got a Bachelor of Advanced Science in Pre-Medicine from the University of Technology, Sydney. You're also, as we can see here, an advocate. You're a board member and co-founder of the Australian Rohingya Women's Development Organisation. So that in itself says something. How are you processing all of the things that you've gone through? From my point of view, maybe Michelle's, you're still a young person who's gone through such a lot. How have you been regarding your future after living with so many years of uncertainty?
I think because Australia has a lot of opportunities and also a lot of people in the community and in our society that really care about stateless people and refugees, despite that conversation not being as talked about, I was able to have access to certain things, like being able to open a non-profit, the first Rohingya refugee-led organisation in Australia, to help our community and give back to the people that have supported us and spoke for us and helped us find our own voice. So for me, being able to, despite these challenges that has affected us in so many ways and was stopped us from getting access to, like, you know, basic human rights and support and jobs and education. I think being able to do this as a former stateless person, I have the lived experience and also the learned experience, and being able to reach out the same hand that been reached out to me. So this is how I'm giving back, because I really care about the things that are not just affecting me, but everyone else, because everyone deserves to have the right to identify as who they believe they are, and being able to not be dictated, like their life being dictated by a paper.
Identity is always such a complex issue. Some people like to think that it's simple, and it can be simple for a lot of people. But ASMA, after all of this experience, I don't know if this is too difficult to answer, and maybe you can't answer it yet, but do you feel like you now, because of you're through that system, you're feeling more like you belong?
I do. I struggled for a long time with sense of belonging. As I've mentioned before, I felt like an alien for a long time because of my legal status. But now I've learned that despite what the system sees me as. I have the right to self-determination and being able to not just inspire others, but also be able to help them find their own voice. I think I constantly have mixed emotions of happiness and grief, because two things can be true at the same time. You can grieve and feel sad about the things that's happened and shouldn't have not happened, but also feel great and be motivated to continue working in advocacy, in constantly working with other people to spread awareness and also to change things systematically as well.
Well, Asma, it's been absolutely wonderful to meet you and to hear from you. And Michelle, thank you as well for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's Asma Nayimula, who is an Australian Rohingya leader now, and Michelle Foster, who's Dean of Law at Melbourne University. And that's about the report from the Peter McMullen Centre on Statelessness at Melbourne Law School. It is the Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. I have this on text. What an amazing young lady. I wish her all the best. Asma's experience will give her an edge over many. We are all, at the end of the day, in the same boat. That is all we want to be, treated with respect and given the same opportunities. Go get 'em, Asma. That is that on text. And to that texter, Asma is smiling. She has heard all of that. Also, I want to hear from you. The conversation is not yet done. I still want to hear from you about your favourite bit of merch. What is the merch that you are getting together for the Socceroos v USA tomorrow morning? Also, coming up next, I'm going to be hearing about whether everyone pulled their weight on the human chain to get all of the wonderful goods that you donated for Meals for Melbourne. That is coming up next with Kate Need. Maybe something to get us into the atmosphere for the Socceroos match. A little bit of pumping up. Everyone's a winner, baby, that's the truth. It's the truth. Making them to you is such a thrill. Everyone's a winner, baby, that's no lie. That's no lie. You never fail to satisfy. Everyone's a winner. No one will say that tomorrow. We need a winner. Just one. Kate Mead's a winner. She's, of course, you know her. She's the 774 station reporter. She starts early and she works this late. And she was there to, what, supervise the human chain, Kate?
Supervise is one way of putting it. Absolutely. I come to you from the loading docks of the ABC.
Excellent.
I've got the bins around me. The garbage truck has just left. But 15 good ABC soldiers, presenters and staff made this human chain. And it is the work of Melbourne, really, that we saw. It was the work of the listeners that really come to fruition, and a few bad backs and a few knees.
Was that ref?
He was doing a lot of talking. I've got to admit, there was a lot of talking going on.
And I say that in jest, because Raf is fitter than three people. So, yeah.
And he's still in the building, so we have to be careful what we say. But more than 30 boxes were filled to the brim. I'm talking overflowing, to the point where they were repacking boxes. And, you know, over $30,000. And this all started with the story of John from Ringwood ringing and saying that he had not eaten for 3 days and was just drinking water to try and feel full or to help him believe that. And Melbourne rallied. They heard John's story. They knew that he wasn't alone. And now we've watched the truck leave a delivery to Food Bank, which will make sure that the people that need it get that food. So, you know, like in terms of the presenters and the staff, look, they did a good job, but Melbourne are the winners today.
All of the people who donated and everyone who sent their best wishes, whether through those physical ones or on the virtual drive as well, you were all part of the human chain. Kate, you great human. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm going to load up a couple of bins and then I'll...
Good. Keep working.
I'll get back to it.
Excellent.
Thanks, Mary.
Kate Mead reporting from the bowels of the building as she reports from all over Melbourne and Victoria as we need her. And thank you so much. on behalf of everyone here at 774 for all of those wonderful donations, on behalf of John as well, I'm sure I am speaking. We have been talking on the Conversation Hour today about a lot of things. This on text about asthma and Michelle and statelessness in Australia. Someone says, I didn't know we had stateless people in Australia. It reminds me of the movie The Terminal with Tom Hanks as well. I do need to see that film. Also, I've been asking you about your merch. Do you like merch? Do you not like merch? Richard from Kingville says, we're filling up the world with non-biodegradable acrylic fan gear, supporter scarves and jumpers. He even mentions MND beanies as well. It's terrible. I have woolen team scarf I've had for years. I keep it in a sealed bag to deter the moths. That's Richard. Linda in Dingley Village says, we have two handmade knitted Geelong football scarves, the length of Doctor Who's scarf, made lovingly for my two sons many years ago by my dear elderly mum who since passed away, treasured always. Oh, Linda, that is fantastic, and that will keep you warm. And a Geelong fan needs some warmth as well. Brian in Ballarat says, at the same time as the Socceroos match, my 50-year-old daughter is running in the Norwegian Midnight Sun Marathon, starting at 8:30 p.m. local time and finishing in daylight after midnight. She's running with her 28-year-old eldest son. Starts at Tromso above the Arctic Circle, and she lives in Melbourne. Brian, that's what you'll be doing. Looking at that pre-dawn activity, of course, we know that many Melburnians will be heading to the pub in the pre-dawn. What will you be doing? Have you already got your preps in place for the 5 a.m. kickoff? Will you be staying at home, quietly chewing your nails, your fingernails and your whatever else you've got on hand, your snacks? Thank you so much for joining me on the Conversation Hour. Listen again on the ABC Listen app. Talk to you next week.